So I guess we can go ahead and start. So thanks everybody for coming to this panel. Very much appreciate you being at the conference as well. So climate displacement, migration, and white nationalism. As far as the format goes, we're gonna have Carmen Gonzalez and Sony Shah give two brief presentations, but then we really wanna open it up so everybody can ask questions. You know, I will remind everybody that journalists have priority in asking questions. You know, don't make speeches, ask questions. State your name and affiliation when asking a question, and thank you for being here. So,
do you want the mic stand up there?
So if you, when you ask a question, you can either come here to this mic here, or if you want the camera for them to see is here.
That's what I'm thinking. I'll move this up there.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. Okay,
I mean, just so
yeah, that's, yeah,
yeah.
That's good. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Cool.
Yeah. It's... Can you guys see me here?
Yeah, that's great. Thank
yeah?
you.
Okay, well, great. Awesome. Okay, so let's start with introductions. Sony Shah is an investigative journalist and author of critically acclaimed and prize-winning books on science, human-animal relations, and international politics. Her 2020 book, The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move, a finalist for the 2021 Penn E.O. Wilson Literary Science Writing Award, was selected as a best nonfiction book of 2020 by Publishers Weekly, a best science book of 2020 by Amazon, and a best science and technology book of 2020 by Library Journal, and was the main one of the main reasons I even became really aware of this issue that we're having this panel on. Her 2016 book, Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, has been called superbly written, bracingly intelligent, provocative, and chilling, a lively, rigorously researched, and highly informative read, and absorbing, complex, and ominous. It was selected as a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and a finalist for the 2017 Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Science and Technology, the New York Public Library's Helen Bernstein Book Award for Excellence in Journalism, and the National Association of Science Writers Science and Society Award. Is there any, Sony, would you like me to add anything else to your biography at this point?
No, that's
okay.
Great.
Okay, all right, thank you. Carmen G. Gonzalez is a Morris I. Wieman Professor of Law at Loyola University Chicago School of Law. She's a world-renowned expert in international environmental law, environmental justice, human rights, and the environment, and food security. Professor Gonzalez has taught in numerous prestigious academic institutions around the globe and has participated in environmental law capacity projects in Asia, Latin America, and the former Soviet Union. She was a Fulbright Scholar in Argentina, a visiting scholar at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom, a visiting professor at the Hopkins Nanjing Center in China, and a U.S. Supreme Court Fellow. She later served as a George Soros visiting chair at the Central European University School of Public Policy in Budapest, Hungary, and as a Norton Rose Fulbright Distinguished Visiting Professor at the University of Houston Law Center. In 2019, she was recognized by Vermont Law School as a Distinguished International Environmental Law Scholar. Professor Gonzalez is past chair of the Environmental Law Section of the Association of American Law Schools and served as board member, or as member and vice chair of the IUCN Academy of Environmental Law. She serves on the board of trustees of Earth Justice, the largest public interest environmental law firm in the United States. Prior to becoming a law professor, she clerked for U.S. District Court Judge Felton E. Henderson in San Francisco, practiced law with Pillsbury, Madison, and Sutro, and served as assistant regional counsel at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. So very grateful to have you both here. I just want to, for those who have just come in, just remind folks, so the format is going to be, have Carmen and Sonia brief presentations, and then we're going to just open it up for a conversation and dialogue, and we'll hopefully have you folks come and use the microphone here so they can see you too and hear you. So with that, I will turn it over to Sonia. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thanks, everyone, for coming. And I just want to give a presentation about sort of how I developed my thinking and reporting on migration, and in particular climate migration. I started reporting on migration in around 2015 during the so-called Mediterranean migrant crisis. And this is right after I had finished writing my book, Pandemic, which is about infectious disease outbreaks. And so I saw this migrant crisis unfolding in the Mediterranean, which, you know, Syrians and Afghans were coming, people from Africa were on their way to Western and Northern Europe and getting stuck. As borders were closing, they were getting stuck in Southern Europe, in particular in Greece and other Southern European countries, and having huge political consequences just across Europe and the United States. There was right-wing anti-migrant leaders coming to power. Borders were closing everywhere. Trump was starting his anti-migrant campaign here in the United States. And so I thought, well, here are these populations, you know, coming from places where infrastructure was weak or broken, and they're moving into these new areas where there's, you know, host populations that have a different disease environment. And when populations collide, that is often a driver for a new outbreak. So I thought this could be a public health issue, that this migrant crisis could add, you know, have another layer of catastrophe, which is a health crisis. So I got a grant from the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting to report the story. I lined up several assignments from editors, and I went to Greece to report on the story. And when I got there, I learned that all of the assumptions I had made, and which my editors and my funders had sanctioned, were wrong. So I started talking to aid doctors who were working with these populations. These are people stuck in makeshift camps. And it turns out they weren't bringing new diseases at all. On the contrary, there was this well-documented effect that was in the medical literature. I had not heard of it, but which I learned about, called the healthy migrant effect. Which is that migrants are generally healthier than the host populations they enter. And if you think about it even for 2 seconds, it makes sense, because migration itself requires what they call portable capital, things you can take with you, your skills, your social contacts, your good health. So they have fewer non-communicable diseases, they smoke less, they have less obesity. If they do get sick, they recover faster. All kinds of ways in which migrants are healthier. So the only health problems that were occurring in these populations were not because of the migrants themselves, it was because of how they were being treated. So they were being housed in really unsanitary ways and with a lot of crowding, with no access to childhood vaccines and stuff. So they were getting scabies, they were getting lice, the kids were getting chickenpox, that kind of thing. So I remember talking to one aid doctor in particular, and I don't remember exactly what I was asking him during this interview, but I was, things like, well, what are some of the health impacts of this migrant crisis? And he kind of stopped me right there, and he said, there is no migrant crisis. And I was like, well, borders are closing, there's protests, there's huge camps of detained people, politicians are going on and on about this, like, there's all this tumult happening, like, what is that then if it's not a migrant crisis? And he said, well, we have plenty of jobs in Europe. There was labor shortages in a number of countries. We have plenty of housing. Even in Greece, there was lots of vacant housing at the time. So he said, we can absorb this number of new people. There is no crisis of migration. The crisis is a crisis of welcome. And that really struck me deeply, because I'm the product of long distance migration. My parents are immigrants from South Asia. I married an immigrant. I'm not a xenophobe, and yet I had made all these assumptions, and not just I hadn't just made them in a vacuum. I had pitched this story, so my funders had made the had implicitly sanctioned these same assumptions, and I hadn't really examined the kind of fundamental parameters of this migrant flow. Like, if you wanted to decide it was a crisis, you would want to look at, is there absorptive capacity in the places where the migrants are going? Is it life-saving for the migrants themselves? And how does it affect the resilience of the places they leave behind? So those are all of the three things you'd want to look at to determine whether a migrant flow was catastrophic or not. But I hadn't done any of that. I had reflexively decided, okay, people are moving, therefore there's a crisis, therefore catastrophic things will happen. So this started kind of a new journey for me. I wanted to understand where this idea had embedded itself in my mind. And first I started kind of looking at all the different arguments that are offered, to justify this idea that migration is a crisis. Well, they cause economic problems, they cause security risks, they cause cultural conflicts, they cause health problems. And I looked at the research at all of these arguments, and not one of them is supported by the evidence. It's true, migrants exact an economic cost in the first generation, but by the second generation, there's a benefit, and the first generation, there's a benefit. The second generation is sort of an order of magnitude bigger than the initial cost of accommodating migrants. So the economic argument is bogus. The security argument is bogus. Migrants cause fewer crimes in host populations, unless you count the act of migration as a crime itself, which is how anti-migrants advocates get their statistics. The cultural argument is also bogus. Anthropologists have documented in great detail how people assimilate to new cultures really rapidly. Even in the first generation, their bodies start to change. You kind of change to the mean. Your health starts to match the local population. This is why kids will pick up a new language and culture sort of effortlessly. So unless there's barriers to assimilation, human populations, when they overlap, they mix. They create new hybrid cultures, new hybrid populations. And within a generation, you literally can't tell the child of an immigrant apart from the child of a resident by any of the standard kind of demographic or health measures. So when I spoke to anti-migrant advocates to kind of dig a little deeper, once you dispense with all these other arguments, they offer the final, and really what I think is the driving argument, which is, well, they just don't belong here. So then my question became, well, where do they belong? And who decides that? And if we look at the scientific literature, our genetic structure indicates that we've been migrants all along. We know this from paleogenetics and also from modern genetics, that we walked out of Africa, we populated the continents, and then we didn't just stay still, we kept moving around. People from North America came back into Europe, came back into Asia, went into Africa, and came back. Complicated pathways, and whenever our populations overlapped, they mixed, they melded, they created new hybrid populations. So you really can't say that we belong in any one place in a kind of permanent way. So this idea that we do is a very peculiar one. It was... began during the Enlightenment era in Europe with people such as Carl Linnaeus, who created our first taxonomies that became the basis for all of our biological sciences today. And basically he decided that every kind of people and animal and plant belonged wherever he found them at that moment. And this is because in his mind, everything had been created by God, and so everything was already in its perfect place because that was a reflection of God's perfection. So he kind of erased the possibility of migration and a shared migratory past because of his devotion to his religion, and that was very common at the time. Of course, naturalists were all highly religious people. But his ideas informed the basis for all of our modern ideas about nature and our place in it. So in Linnaean taxonomy, migration becomes something catastrophic because it disrupts nature's order. And that opens up this idea that there is a single place where different kinds of people belong. And we see that then eugenicists took up this idea in the early 20th century to say, well, white Nordic people belong here. Not the Native Americans who we've already displaced, who were here for millennia before us. These new white Nordic people, we're the ones who really belong here. And these new Eastern Europeans, Southern Europeans who are starting to come over in the early 20th century, they're going to pollute the gene pool with their inferior genes. And this is a biological catastrophe in the making. So we need to close the borders. And that very directly influenced our early 20th century immigration laws in which, populations were excluded explicitly based on their race. And then we see this again in the 1970s when population biologists started to sound the alarm about overpopulation, that population growth was going to outstrip natural resources. This kind of harkens back to Malthus. But they were very specific about whose reproduction they were concerned about, and that is black and brown women in Asia and Africa, whose babies, they feared, would overrun the natural resources of the planet. And so that was kind of a problem in and of itself. But then that became a problem of migration more specifically when they just realized that, well, if we have the borders open, all these high reproducing people, black and brown people, are going to come here where they don't belong, and their babies are going to overrun the population and our natural resources here in the United States. And that was taken up to some extent by the environmental movement, the big environmental organizations of the day, led primarily by an advocate named John Tanton, who some of you might have heard of. He started out as a population control advocate, and then he kind of realized that, well, if I care about the reproductive habits of brown and black women, I should care about whether they're going to come into my country. And so he started saying, well, if we care about population control, we should also want to close the borders. And environmental movements, kind of big groups, kind of took that on for a while until it became clear that he had very explicit racial ideas behind that, and they kind of cut him off. But then he went on to partner explicitly with white nationalist groups, and he founded some of the main organizations that are leading the current anti-migrant movement in the United States today. And leaders from those organizations populated the last administration at really high levels. So now we see climate change altering migration patterns, and of course people are moving in response to the shifting climate in new ways, because that is an adaptive response to a dynamic planet. It's a deep part of what it means to be human. It's part of our resilience, it's part of how we adapt to living on this changing planet. And that is being met by this infrastructure that's been influenced by these white nationalist concerns. And I think the broader issue is that we're kind of blind to most migration. People are moving all the time. It's only this tiny fraction of movement that grabs our attention and gets categorized as a crisis. And we see that coming out in the way we pitch stories and the way we report on them. So what I would like to encourage other journalists to do is to kind of rethink those assumptions embedded in the stories that you're pitching and how you frame the stories and how you report on the stories, to kind of rethink migration as not the crisis itself, but part of the solution to the crisis. I'll end there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sonia.
Okay, Sonia, you ended exactly where I started, where I'm going to start.
Great.
Rethinking migration as a form of adaptation and also a form of migration. Even though we know that climate fuel disasters are forcing people all over the world to migrate, there is no national or international legal framework to address climate displacement. The persons who cross international borders are treated as undocumented immigrants, and they face detention, deportation, and increasingly criminal prosecution. The regulation of migration, as Sonia discussed, is among the most consistently racialized practices of states. U.S. immigration policy, for example, has long been rooted in white supremacy. The 1790 Naturalization Act only permitted white persons to be naturalized citizens. In 1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act barred Chinese migration. The Immigration Acts of 1917 and 1924 completely prohibited migration from Asia and restricted migration from Eastern and Southern Europe. It wasn't until 1952 that racial barriers to naturalization were removed, and it wasn't until 1965 that racial preferences that favored migrants from Western and Northern Europe were eliminated. Despite the significance of race in determining who is welcomed with open arms and who is excluded, much of the literature on climate change doesn't grapple to the extent that it should with racism and with its close cousin, colonialism. If we take a step back and look at not just immediate problems, but historic root causes, racism and colonialism are embedded in the history of fossil fuels. Historians have long recognized that the colonization of the Americas and the transatlantic slave trade provided the capital, the cotton, the food that made the Industrial Revolution, which launched the age of fossil fuels, possible. Fossil fuels, at every stage in their life cycle, poison black and brown communities. From the Niger Delta to the Canadian tar sands to Cancer Alley in the United States, black, brown, indigenous communities are disproportionately living and dying in the shadow of petroleum refineries, oil drilling, power plants, oil and gas pipelines. Fossil fuels are also concentrated in particular regions of the world, such as the Middle East, that have been targeted over and over for invasion, occupation, and exploitation. and that ironically, when displaced Arab and Muslim populations seek refuge in Europe or the United States, they're racialized, they're classified as terrorists and denied admission. Finally, those most susceptible to climate-related disasters and slow onset event are overwhelmingly Black and brown folks in affluent countries and in the global south. They live in areas disproportionately exposed to hurricanes, floods, droughts, rising sea levels, but they have also been rendered vulnerable to climate change, to colonialism and its aftermath, including military interventions, Cold War proxy wars between the United States and the Soviet Union, predatory lending, onerous austerity measures imposed by the IMF and the World Bank. These interventions have increased poverty and deprived people of the resources needed for climate adaptation and disaster risk reduction. When persons who are racialized as non-white cross into the global north, even though most stay in their own country or migrate to neighboring countries, we get this racial panic. Oh my God, this is a disaster, as Sonia was saying, even though migration is the history of the world, the history of humans. So reports on climate change rarely talk about issues of racism and colonialism. And some environmentalists have used the specter of mass migration to try to prod governments into action, but this has backfired spectacularly. It has promoted this discourse of threats to national security. It has stoked white nationalism, and it has resulted in bigger walls, greater militarization, instead of the kinds of action on climate change that we would all like to see happen. So I want to say a couple of words about Central American migration, just to have provide a very concrete context that is particularly relevant to the United States. Central America is one of the world's most climate vulnerable regions, due to its geographic location and also its elevated levels of poverty. Getting to this question of reparation, how should we think about Central America's vulnerability? Well, first, a community's vulnerability to climate change is a function of two variables. One is geographic exposure, and the other is economic and social capacity to withstand the blow. So let's begin with exposure. Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, the countries where most Central American migrants are coming from, are located in an area that is hyper-vulnerable to extended drought and also to floods. The mega drought of 2014-2015 produced enormous crop losses and left more than 500,000 people on the brink of starvation. In 2020, late 2020, two back-to-back hurricanes devastated Honduras and Guatemala and left hundreds of thousands of people homeless. The United States and other high-emitting countries are disproportionately responsible for the growing exposure of Central America to severe weather events, because these are the countries that have contributed the most to climate change and have done very little to address the problem. But that's not all. The U.S. is also disproportionately responsible for Central America's economic and social vulnerability, its limited capacity to withstand these shocks. Beginning in the 19th century, the U.S. invaded, occupied, and overtly or covertly interfered in Central America in order to extract its natural resources and exploit its labor force. The U.S. racialized Latinos and Latinas as inferior in order to justify the expansion of white settlers, first into Mexico and later into Central America and the Caribbean. Ironically, one of these stereotypes is that Latinos are just lacking in democratic institutions. But when democratically elected progressive leaders did come to power in Central America, the U.S. overthrew them. Many of these interventions are well known. The 1954 U.S. overthrow of the democratically elected president of Guatemala. The decades-long civil wars in Guatemala and El Salvador, financed by the United States, that killed and displaced hundreds of thousands of civilians. The militarization of Honduras following the 1911 U.S.-backed coup and the most recent military coup in 2009. The ongoing pressure to open these economies to mining, large-scale biofuel plantations, and agribusiness, while displacing peasants, indigenous peoples, and Afro-descendant communities. As a result of these interventions, the entire region experiences high levels of poverty and unemployment, an upsurge in drug trafficking, and high levels of violence. So the U.S. and other high-emitting nations increased the exposure of Central American countries to climate change, and they also reduced the economic and social capacity of Central American states to withstand the ravages of climate change. Notwithstanding this responsibility, the Department of Homeland Security continues to portray migration as a threat to national security, right, with the resulting consequences being the hardening of borders, et cetera. What would it mean to reconceptualize migration as a form of reparation? Well, some climate law scholars have argued that high-emitting countries have an obligation to admit climate-displaced peoples into their territory, at least in proportion to their contribution to climate change, based on the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, which is at the heart of the climate treaties. The principle of common but differentiated responsibilities recognizes that countries have an obligation to act in proportion to their contribution to the problem, that affluent countries that contribute disproportionately to the problem and have more resources need to take the lead and take action. Migration law scholars have argued that powerful states that impose damaging economic policies on other states, that intervene militarily, that overthrow democratically elected governments, that finance civil wars, have an obligation to admit as migrants those who have been harmed by these policies. So these two ideas together reframe migration and displacement. There's a tendency to think of states as billiard balls with hard borders that occasionally slam into each other. But the reality is that states are not autonomous, independent, and territorially bounded, but are deeply interconnected, historically and currently, politically, economically, and that migration, as Sonia well pointed out, is the rule rather than the exception. Climate displaced persons are migrating most commonly within their own country, and then to nearby countries, and then ultimately to the countries whose colonial and post-colonial interventions created poverty and increased vulnerability to climate change. There's a wonderful recent book on the British Empire and migration to the UK that's applicable in this situation too, and its title is "We're Here Because You Were There." But we often forget that in the narratives on migration, that deeper historic connection is forgotten and not addressed. So reframing migration as reparation has two components: reparation for climate change, reparation for the centuries of economic and military interventions that have eroded the capacity to be able to adapt to climate change. And by migration as reparation, I don't mean turning a blind eye as migrants are raped and brutalized trying to cross borders, but rather recognizing a right to relocation and resettlement. These ideas may seem unthinkable in the current climate of racialized hostility toward immigrants, but they become very thinkable if the reports on climate change are reframed and looked at through a different lens. And it's important to remember that racism is not just ignorance and prejudice. It's really lucrative. Who benefits from restrictive immigration policies? Well, first, the defense contractors, the security firms, the for-profit detention centers that receive very generous government contracts. Secondly, the security apparatus of the state. Third, the businesses that exploit migrant workers, especially those who are undocumented. Fourth, the criminal enterprises that engage in human trafficking and can charge higher fees when border controls increase. The New York Times recently reported on large numbers of undocumented immigrant children who have been turned over to human traffickers and are now being exploited in slave-like conditions. And then finally, racism is deployed in cynical and manipulative ways by politicians to maintain the policies that have created unprecedented economic inequality and are bringing the planet's life support systems to the brink of collapse. Climate change inflicts disproportionate harm on those who were on the receiving end of colonialism, the losing end of globalization. Those who benefited the least from the fossil fuel-based global economy but are now suffering its worst impacts. Climate displaced persons are the canaries in the coal mine. They may be the first to suffer the ravages of climate change, but their plight is the harbinger of what is to come for everyone. Instead of demonizing migrants and treating migration as the crisis, it would be much more productive to place the climate crisis in historic context as part and parcel of a much longer history of injustice. I'll end here, and I welcome your thoughts and comments.
Thank you, Congressman.
Okay, so just to take a full advantage of our time, I just want to open it up to Q&A. If you have a question that you would like to ask Governor Sonia, please come up to this microphone here. A reminder, this, journalists are prioritized. Say your name, say your affiliation, no speeches. Thank you.
Hi, can you hear me okay? Hi, my name is Jen Thames. I'm a freelance science reporter. So my question is primarily for Carmen. You had talked about how policies in the global north had historically caused vulnerabilities in global southern countries in terms of responding to climate change. And I was wondering what the current policies in the global north, or policies we've recently seen in the global north around restrictive migration controls, if those are also creating further vulnerabilities in those countries of origin.
Absolutely. So essentially what we're seeing is the criminalization of those who have been affected by this very long history of interventions, right, that undermined their livelihoods in their countries of origin. And those who are now also being affected by the consequences of climate change that are a function of the failure of the United States for decades to take even the most minimal action to address the problem of climate change. And so instead of responding with empathy, with understanding, with an acceptance of responsibility, what's happening is the absolute worst. It was terrible under the Trump administration, right, where you had children placed in cages. But even though the rhetoric of the Biden administration may sound more compassionate, turning a blind eye as people are brutalized and raped and try to enter the country, that's not compassionate, right? That's extremely cruel. No one should have to come, should have to migrate under those circumstances. In the South Pacific, there's a concept that has been developed called migration dignity. And I think we really need to think about how do we ensure that those who are migrating, right, which is happening currently and has happened historically, are doing so in a dignified manner that recognizes their human rights. And I want to contrast what's happening with Central American migrants, to use one example, or migrants from the Middle East and Africa and Europe, with the treatment of Ukrainians. Because Ukrainians are not racialized as non-white, because they're perceived as white, those 6 million people who have fled since the invasion of Russia have been welcomed with open arms. There's a recognition that, of course, they can be integrated into the country. Even in the highly immigration-restricted United States, there is a program for resettlement that offers them immediate work authorization, access to benefits, right? Unthinkable in terms of how other migrants are treated. So it's a lack of political will. It's a continuation of many of the processes that I've described to treat migrants the way that they're treated in the United States, if they are from certain countries in the world.
Thank you, Carmen. Sonia, did you want to respond to that?
You're muted, Sonia.
No, I don't think I have much to add. That was a great answer that Carmen gave. So yeah, let's move on. If there's other people, if other questioners are there, otherwise I could say a few things, but if there's other questions, let's hear them.
Yeah, I think folks are letting them. Just please identify yourself and your affiliation.
Yeah, thank you to both those fabulous introductory statements and eye-opening new vocabulary. My name's Nadia White. I'm the director of environmental journalism program and at the University of Montana, and a journalist myself. My question really is about places like Montana and Idaho, which are seeing kind of a forerunner of migration, where we're having a lot of immigration by people who can move, wealthy white people mostly, who are being kind of displaced, I think, and I don't know that the research is showing this, but the instinct is, they're being displaced. There's kind of this front wave of migration that is, I think, imbuing the conversation in these northern latitudes with some racialized dialogue. And if you have thoughts on how to address those stories journalistically, that is effective for policy planning in the midterm. So how do cities and states in the north, northern United States specifically in this case, establish themselves as more forward-thinking places for climate migration? Thank you.
That's a great question. Thank you for that. I can jump in with a couple comments, Carmen, if that's okay. I think what's happening is sort of an almost racialization within the country based on ideology. So, you know, the urban elites or the cosmopolitans versus the rurals, or, you know, however the ideological divides are happening, where you see this depersonalizing rhetoric on the, you know, towards the other side, which is very familiar from racial rhetoric and animalization and all those things. So I think some of the same political dynamics that we see in, you know, a border crisis on our southern border could also happen within a state now because of this new kind of depersonalization within what would otherwise be called the same racial group. So I think that is starting to happen. And the way I have kind of navigated, like, how do you report on these things is, if you want to say that, look, people moving into new places is not inherently bad, it's not inherently catastrophic for the places they enter, you want to look at kind of all three angles, like, okay, is it good for, what is the impact in the host society, what is the impact on the migrants themselves, what is the impact on the places they leave behind, that those are the three parts of the story that really need to be there. I think usually we only look at one part of that, what's going to happen in the host society, it's going to be so hard for them, you know, and that's the angle. And sometimes we get the human interest story about the migrant themselves. But I think we need to look at all three of those things. And also, the other angle, I think, is even maybe more important. If migration is actually adaptive and is a solution and is how we kind of can be resilient in the face of all these changes we're facing, then the real crisis is not the migration, it's the entrapment of people. So if you look at, well, what happens if you trap people in places where they're going to be vulnerable to wildfires in California, for example, or you trap people in low-lying island nations where if there's one superstorm, like, nobody can leave because the whole place is, like, only 3 feet above sea level. You know, so that's the other side of the story, and maybe that's where more of our story should be pitched. Where are these people coming from, and how bad, you know, is it better for them to stay there and be vulnerable in those ways? In which case, you know, I mean, even if you're thinking from a completely selfish point of view, you know, I did some reporting in Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian, when nobody was able to evacuate because, as Carmen said, there's no legal pathways. A lot of people wanted to leave. They knew these storms were coming. They were getting worse, but there was no legal way to do that. And so what happens is then the catastrophe happens and you have this impulse for mass migration where people need and want to move all at once, with no planning, with no pathways, with no safeguards at all. And that is much more disruptive for everybody. It's more disruptive for the migrants, it's more disruptive for the host populations, and it's more disruptive for the places they leave behind. So, you know, these are things we could manage better so that we don't have these outbursts of crises. You know, we're not lurching from crisis to crisis, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that way. So I think there's ways to kind of rethink the way we pitch the stories and angle the stories and who we centralize in stories about migration that could kind of bring up, you know, this larger context that puts migration in a better light. So we're not really buying into the whole propaganda that migration is, that it's migration that's the problem as opposed to the other things that are actually the problem.
And if I can add to that, another way of thinking about it is, why are we allowing parts of the planet to be turned into sacrifice zones where the land is degraded beyond rehabilitation and people are trapped? right? That's the real story. That's the atrocity, right? That's not being reported enough. And that's where we should be asking, why do people think that leaving is the only alternative? The problem is not that they're choosing to adapt. The problem is that they're making the best of a problematic situation. Why aren't we addressing the underlying problematic situation and instead are focusing on the symptom and not the root cause?
Hi, my name is Adelon, and I'm a journalist in California covering climate and energy policy at the state level. Just a quick question, you know, when it comes to actually putting laws together, getting policies passed, you know, the nuts and bolts of addressing climate change as well as environmental justice, would love to hear, you know, what are some questions you think journalists should be asking, and, you know, considerations that we should have as we report on this legislation.
I think one of the things that journalists can do that are helpful, there's often this catastrophism that accompanies any discussion of climate change. It's too big, we're too powerless, what can we do? And so on the one hand, it is important to address, as Sonia and I were discussing, some of the underlying root causes. But I think one of the best things that journalists can do is to highlight the positive examples and give people a sense of hope and that there's a place where they can interject themselves and be part of solutions. So, for instance, as someone who teaches environmental law, I devote a significant amount of time to some of California's innovations. They're not perfect. We're going to look at them. We're going to critique them. But it reminds people of the incredibly important role, not just of the federal government, but also of the states in being climate leaders. And the closer you bring it to where people live, what you're doing is making it clear that there's a place where they can assert themselves, that they're not passive observers, that they play a role in how this legislation develops, what directions it takes. So, for example, there have been a number of very controversial things that were done by California, such as the cap and trade program for greenhouse gas emissions, that could be a disaster because they often tend to concentrate emissions in low-income communities and communities of color. But there was a mobilization by organizations and elected officials to have climate justice front and center in how California approached the problem of climate change. That is a superb example, but a lot of people don't hear about it. And they don't know it, even though it should and could be replicated, obviously adjusted to appropriate conditions, but everywhere. So I think that's really one important function, to report this and not just as a local story, but rather this is an example of what could easily be done elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other thing I would add is, and when talking to policymakers, is I think a lot of policymaking is, you know, of course, it's going to be, it's public facing, so it has a role as a PR role. And a lot of times that's about barring migration or making sure that migration isn't going to be disruptive. So we're going to close the borders, we're going to make it harder, we're going to, you know, all those things. And I would encourage anyone who's reporting on those things to delve into the vast amounts of social science research that shows that those things don't actually stop migration. Migrants continue to move, they just do so in more dangerous ways. So then you get a higher body count, you get more people going in more deadly areas, they're going deeper into the desert, they're going far out into the ocean, they're hiring smugglers, whatever they're doing. They're not going to stop migrating because the borders are closed and there's no legal pathways. They keep going, it just gets worse. So when policymakers are responding to a migrant flow with efforts to minimize it, to close the, you know, to pull up the ladder, so to speak, then I think reporters should be armed with this social science research that tells us that, well, that's not going to work. They're going to still come in. They're just going to come in different ways that is going to be more, potentially more disruptive and more dangerous for them and also for others. So what policymakers really need to do if they care about migration being responsible, doing responsible governance, is to manage migration as a reality. That this is going to happen. How are we going to make it safe? How are we going to make it dignified? How are we going to make it orderly for the host populations and also for migrants themselves? You know, so that should be, the question should all be around that. That's the expectation of a policymaker. This is going to happen. This is going to happen more and more. And how are we going to manage it? Not to say, oh, close the borders, pull up the ladders. That's just not going to work. And I think if we arm ourselves with the social science research, there's a wealth of studies out there that show that those kinds of bans don't end migration. It just makes it, you know, worse and more dangerous.
Thank you.
Sonia, you mentioned that one of the things to consider is, when you're reporting on this, is to consider the impact of the country that they're leaving behind. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more specifically about that. Like, what are the impacts you've seen on climate migration of the countries that these people are leaving behind?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And migration helps in a lot of ways, the host societies that leave behind, because migrant remittances is a big part of that. That's one of the biggest forms of foreign GDP for a lot of nations. Migrants go into new places and they form that, you know, a link between these different societies. And it can be a real equalizing force to move resources, wealth and resources across borders in ways that can have a reparations effect, like Carmen was talking about. So I think that's one part of it. And then, of course, migrants bring other migrants along. These are social networks that can be created. And so, you know, this is part of the whole reality of migration. This is by looking at the whole picture, then, you know, we get the full context, that it's not just, yes, when migrants move into a new society, you have to make room, and that can be hard. Like, change is hard. You know, you got to make room in schools. You got to make room in the economy. You got to make room in the housing market. That's all true. Yes, I don't think anyone who studies migration would say, oh, migration's easy. Let's just open all the borders and let people go where they want. It is hard. It is disruptive. So this is something we can manage. And, you know, the consequences are going to play out in lots of different ways. And let's think deeply about all of those. So in some cases, I think you could really make an argument that when people leave, that it creates a benefit for the societies that they're leaving, as well as the societies that they're entering. But those are things you have to look at, you know. So that's evidence based. I don't think you can say, like, in every case that's true, right? Like, it's going to vary from case to case. But remittances are going to be one easy way to look into that, and there's lots of research on remittances and the role they play in different economies.
One thing that I've been writing about that goes to this question of what impact does it have on those left behind is I was really struck at the increasing numbers of indigenous peoples who are migrating. Things have to be really bad for that to happen, because for indigenous peoples, the land is the culture. The land is the spirit. The land is everything. And when you leave that and we're forced to assimilate to a different culture, that's ethnocide. And from a legal standpoint, often their rights are based on ancestral territories. So if you move, you no longer have that right, the rights that are recognized under international human rights law. So that would be an example of the consequences can be devastating. They can be quasi-genocidal. So we really need to think about what that means, and thinking about making migration available as an option, but also responsibility to allow people to remain behind, who want to be behind, who want to stay in the place that is representative of them culturally, spiritually, historically. That's a different obligation that we need to be thinking about, because it really is a continuation of this genocidal project in new forms when people are forced to leave, are relocated involuntarily yet again.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Smith. Thank you for being here. I'm a freelance journalist. I would love to hear both of your thoughts on, in the United States, the communities that are often most impacted by climate change on the front lines of it are communities of color. These same communities have, for decades, centuries, been subjected to policies that tear them apart, redlining, urban renewal, forced incarceration. And so I'd just love to hear thoughts on how we can support migration of those communities where they need to move without replicating the harm of those past policies. Thank you.
I'll just say a couple things first, Carmen, if you don't mind, that I would problematize that initial assumption you're making, because there's there's a lot of interesting examples because sea level rise is affecting coastal communities. In a lot of places, coastal communities are where the wealthy people are living. So it's not necessarily true that the most vulnerable people are always going to be the people who are most vulnerable to all the other kinds of environmental problems we have, like, you know, the siting of toxic dumps and waste incineration and all the other forms of environmental racism, which are real and are happening. Climate change is kind of, I think, actually has a somewhat differential effect compared to those kinds of problems. Coastal communities, for one thing, you know, there's this great example in Miami where nobody wanted to live up in the hills. And so those were all populated by the Haitian immigrants. And this is, you know, very vibrant Haitian community that's up in the like highlands now. And now there's developers who want to like buy them out and get rid of them, you know, violently displace them because now all the rich people want to move up high, into higher ground. So, you know, I think it's not necessarily true that it's always communities of color that are most vulnerable. And that provides interesting opportunities to report on environmental racism. Like, you know, okay, if in certain cases we want to put our toxic dumps on Native American reservations and we do our mining in Black communities, but, you know, now that their lands are considered valuable under climate change, you know, the whole logic is being reversed. So I would look more deeply at some of those examples too. I think they're really interesting ways of scrambling our assumptions about who belongs where and what they're entitled to.
Well, I would say the one thing we also want to look at is how old patterns manage to reassert themselves in new contexts. So there's a concept of environmental gentrification that you may be familiar with, and Little Haiti is an example, that as we realize this community, right, that was once, abandoned by rich, wealthy white people, has the best land in terms of dealing with climate change, that it's at a higher elevation, the land is becoming much more attractive to developers. As the land becomes more attractive to developers, property values increase. Renters are squeezed out, and even homeowners find that they can no longer afford their property taxes. So that's something to pay attention to, because areas that were once considered undesirable are now being the new sites of gentrification and new forms of displacement. Ironically, environmental gentrification happens in other ways too. Sometimes when an area is cleaned up, right, through the Superfund program, for example, the result is a rise in property values. We see this in the Bay Area, right, in the Hunters Point neighborhood. And the people who used to live there and who bore the pollution for decades are now displaced because they can no longer afford to live there. So I agree with Sonia that climate change is scrambling things, but these patterns have a way of reproducing themselves in new ways if we're not paying attention.
German's international broadcaster. I'm a correspondent in Zambia. And right now in my country, I don't know if you know, it's the second largest producer of copper in Africa. And our neighbor, the Democratic Republic of Congo, is the largest producer. And together, these two countries hold over 77% of the world reserves of minerals required to manufacture electric car batteries. And so they signed a memorandum of understanding to start manufacturing these batteries as the world moves from using combustion engines to, you know, electric batteries. It's exciting because it brings about economic opportunities and also helps towards addressing some of the issues the world is facing in terms of climate change. But then environmentalists are worried that something will have to hit. You know, at what cost is it going to be to countries like Zambia, for instance, where three quarters of the people depend on agriculture, for instance, for their livelihoods? And then across the country has minerals buried under water tables, forests, and that kind of stuff. So do we see a situation where increased activity in mining will end up displacing people and affecting some of the land that is supposed to be fertile? And we see that causing a lot of people wanting to migrate to other places in search of greener pastures. Should we, as journalists, be alarming? You know, as much as we talk about the advantages of all these, should we also be talking about disadvantages? How do we frame our stories? And also, should we be pushing for policies from, you know, most of the people that are coming there now to invest from superpowers like here? Should we be asking them to be more responsible in case of such eventualities, and also treat citizens from such countries with like special treatment, you know, in terms of even policies of migration in case we end up in a situation where it becomes dire?
Thank you.
I can jump in first if you'd like. I would say one way of framing it that I have used is that many of the climate solutions use the same logic as the climate problems. They reproduce the same logic of extractivism that created the problems in the first place. And extractivism of nature and extractivism of the underpaid labor, or of the people who are doing the work of mining, for example, and the lack of concern about those who are displaced as a consequence of these projects. So thinking about this in the broader context of mining is a warning, right? That something that may ultimately be good for the planet can be utterly devastating for those most directly affected unless it is handled in an environmentally and socially responsible manner. As someone who works on law, I can tell you the law is not in your favor and you want to hit hard on what's wrong. Most of these mining transactions are handled through investment law, which protects the rights of the foreign investor over and above the needs of the country and the needs of the local people. And so focusing on these unequal, and they are really unequal treaties that nations sign, would be a very interesting thing to highlight, to spotlight, because if a country tries to do the right thing, if it tries to change the law to protect the environment, to protect human rights, the foreign investor has the right to go to arbitration and recover lost profits. That is a very problematic framework, and we can't actually make change in the world in a way that replicates the existing frameworks that got us the problems that we now have in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I would just echo that. And the other, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways in which the solution, some environmental solutions are creating new problems for exactly the reason Carmen's talking about, with, you know, the 30 by 30 biodiversity initiative similarly is could displace a lot of indigenous peoples who have been the best, guardians of biodiversity over millennia. And you see the same thing with mining. And the real issue in underlying your question is that we're not thinking about consumption. You know, our climate solutions are all about, let's not let, you know, Western consumers have to make any sacrifices at all. So we want a one-to-one translation of like the amount of miles that we're doing right now for individual consumers. We're going to do exactly that same amount of miles. We're going to have the exact same amount of roads. And we're going to just do it with electricity. And therefore, we're going to need like a huge amount of more resources. And then we need more mines and more, you know, and it's the same logic of extractivism, of capitalism, and, you know, just the Western ideology that everything in nature is a resource that we can use up at our leisure. And so I think we need to problematize like all aspects of that, you know, like, how much batteries do we really need? Like, who needs to sacrifice for this? Do we need to displace all these people to make these mines so that, you know, who's going to use those batteries to drive around? Where are they going to be driving to? Is this, you know, how many hundreds of miles, thousands of miles a year does a typical American really have to drive? You know, why our whole economy is based on that logic that we all should be able to do this thing, no matter what the costs are. And I think if our climate solutions are just going to accept that logic, then you're going to get these solutions that actually cause some of the same problems that we're running away from to begin with.
And if I could add to that, we could look at something like the Paris Agreement and see how it embodies that same idea that people in the global north should not have to make any sacrifices. If something is going to be done, it's going to be global south that's going to do it. So, for instance, the Paris Agreement allows companies to continue emitting greenhouse gases, but to get offsets if they finance the conservation of forests in the global south. Well, what happens when these forests are conserved in the global south? Typically, the people who wind up being evicted are the indigenous and local peoples who, in fact, have been very good stewards of that land for many, many years. And so the same logic perpetuates itself. And the same people maintain their lifestyle, and the burden is borne by people in the global south. So having multiple examples that illustrates this is the logic, this is the continuation of the same project at the expense of the same people, and without anything ever having to change in the north, I think is very useful, a very useful framing.
Hi, my name is Mariela Esquivel, and I'm a reporter intern with Voces Internship of Idaho, which encourages more Latinos, which helps encourage more Latinos in journalism. One of the things that we've been hitting, especially here in Idaho, and focusing on is the migration also within our agriculture aspect. We have a lot of farms and farm workers here in Idaho, and a lot of them come undocumented from different areas, California, from the border, etc. While then again, these jobs are very much hard labor, dangerous, with the climate change and everything like that, I think it can be very harmful for migrants. But I think for also, you know, some people will argue that it helps the economy, and, you know, which I think is true, but also we have the food crisis that's been going on as well. How do we then, as journalists, highlight how, where these jobs can be dangerous and harmful to migrants who are coming to work, but also then, like, helping them continue to keep jobs and the opportunity that they have also to create a source of income for themselves and their families?
I think this goes back to what Carmen's talking about, is legal pathways. Do you know, if there's industries that rely on undocumented workers, I mean, who benefits from that? It's the industry that benefits, because they don't have to offer any of the safeguards that they have to offer to documented workers, because undocumented workers can't agitate for their rights in the same way that other people with documents can. So those are the burden should be on those industries to explain why it is that they need undocumented workers. And if they want workers who can do good work and who will, you know, be paid a living wage, then they should be first in line lobbying Congress for legal pathways for these people. That's not what they're doing at all, and they are really part of the problem, because their kind of hidden economic incentive and pressure to keep this system going, where you create this underclass of people desperate to come into this country, but don't give them any legal pathways, so that they are purposely stripped of their rights and entitlements in this country. And that is a huge economic benefit for the agricultural industry in this country, and lots of other industries too. So I think that the angle should be, who's benefiting? Where is this money going? Like, why is this state of affairs good? Like, yes, it's true that, okay, so still they're undocumented, at least they get jobs and they can send it back, and, you know, but we're talking about crumbs then, as opposed to the safe and dignified work that they are entitled to.
You said it beautifully. I have nothing to add to that.
That's all right. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Christian. Thank you so much for the panel. I work in a border community in South Texas, and I have a challenge in my reporting where, speaking to migrants, they have other reasons that they state for coming to the U.S., you know, reasons that are more, you can see them, you can feel them, so they won't say climate change. They may not even say recent hurricane. So I know it's just a matter of looking harder, but is there anything that you would suggest to make those connections?
That's a great question, and I encountered that in my own reporting, which is that, you know, and I think the other complicating factor is, because of the way immigration laws work, people have to, you know, manufacture a legitimate reason to explain themselves. And when I started looking at, like, what migration is for Homo sapiens kind of writ large in our history, it's so central to our experience. It's like
trying to say, well, what is the one reason you moved? What is the one reason you migrated? It's like asking a parent, what is the one reason you had a kid? You know, you can't explain it with one reason. There are lots of reasons, you know, and that's how it should be, because this is such a deep impulse in humanity to move around, and actually not just in our species, all the other species do that are moving around as well. So I think it's very difficult to get people who migrate to really explain themselves the way we want to explain themselves. And I think the other part of it is, let's problematize why we want them to tell us what their reason is. You know, why are they the ones who have to explain, why did you come here? By even asking that question, we're saying, well, the normal thing is to stay still and never go anywhere. You're doing something abnormal, therefore I'm going to ask you why, right? But like, if we think of migration as something that people do, that is central to the experience of being human, people are going to move around. So then the question of why they move, the story, you know, maybe that's not really where you want to get the interesting narration of your story. You know, like, oh, well, this happened and this happened and this happened and then they moved, you know, and so you want to try to extract that from your source so that can be the story, do you know? And then maybe the story just needs to be bigger. You need to look at the broader context and not to get the one person to explain, yes, I moved because of the hurricane, but to give that context, the hurricane happened, the poverty happened, the other thing happened, all these things happened, and then all these people were moving, you know, that, you know, let readers draw their own inferences. But it still positions migration as something that just happens. There's no special reason necessarily for it. What we can see is changing patterns, that migration was happening anyway. Patterns are changing because of climate change. Like, you know, historical migration patterns were east to west. Now we're seeing they're much more, they're going to continue to be more north to south in sync with the changing climate. And I think I would encourage a lot of, you know, people who are reporting on migration to also link up with, to look at the migration of other species, because we're not the only ones who have to move in response to climate change. All the other creatures have to move too, and they're doing that. They're shifting their ranges or in sync with the changing climate, for going farther north, going higher up into the mountains. And sometimes some people think that's a problem, but for the most part, experts who are studying that say this is great because this is how we can preserve biodiversity into the future. You know, so anyway, that's kind of a broad answer, but I think there's ways of framing it so that we're not trying to get migrants to say, this is the one reason I moved. I don't think that's a fruitful line of inquiry anymore. Then people will just make stuff up because they have to, and they're coached by lawyers and you know, other people that this is the one reason you have to say, because that's how you'll get in, because only certain reasons are allowed, you know, under our immigration policies.
Part of the reason there's a resistance to having a treaty that deals with climate displacement is because no one will actually really qualify unless you're on a Pacific Island nation where the sea level has inundated everything, because we all know that migration is multi-causal. It can't be just one thing.
Hi, my name's Rocky Kistner. I'm an independent journalist in D.C. I'm a CJ board member. I really appreciate your comments, because I think it reframes a lot of the important issues we're dealing with as environmental journalists, that we need to rethink our assumptions that migration is not contributing to crisis, but part of the solution, and also not trap people in sacrifice zones. I've done a lot of reporting about the BP oil spill, and I believe Louisiana probably encapsulates that more than any other area of the country. The BP spill happened 13 years ago as yesterday. Still has huge stories of health impact and everything. And one of the solutions that the state has come up with the BP oil spill money is to pour fresh water, polluted water from the Mississippi River into the bays and in order to try to build up the land. But in the process, that's going to devastate the fisheries that the fishermen and many indigenous people rely on in the Bayou, and force them probably to leave. So I'm just curious, that story, I believe, hasn't gotten the national attention it deserves, because it's going to affect a lot of people, not only in the region, but around the country because of fisheries. Do you think journalists should be covering these kinds of stories in the frame that you've just articulated, and how can we better, you know, use this frame to get these stories out into the media? Thank you.
That's a hard one. Do you want to go, Carmen?
What? That was my first response. And I hadn't actually been hearing about the story or following the story. Polluting water from the Mississippi River to build up the land and you're going to devastate the fisheries.
Yeah, let me just quickly explain that because it's true. It's actually happening. It's multi-billion-dollar river diversions that are using BP oil spill money that was designed to support coastal restoration. The first river diversion will be $3 billion. That money is, you know, many argue is being spent that's going to wipe out certain fisheries, and there's science behind that. But it is happening, and what I worry is that part of that is it's not getting attention it deserves is because these communities, even though their fisheries are important communities, they're often indigenous communities, and the oil industry, the power structure in Louisiana, very supportive of this, and they want to use the sediment in the river to try to build up the marshland, but you know, they it's like 20 square miles of land over the next 50 years. Good luck predicting that. So anyway, that's the background. Sorry about the complicated stuff there.
I think I'm often struck by techno solutions to problems that ignore ecosystems and people. Why would anyone even think of this? Well, I guess the question is ultimately, who really benefits from this? I think that's maybe the storyline. Who is really benefiting from this? Because it's not the ecosystems, it's not the people who depend on those ecosystems. And who's monitoring this? And who's paying attention? And where is the government in all of this? And why don't we have an environmental impact assessment that thoroughly documents what the consequences are? So that's where I would go with it.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, the other thing that occurs to me is that, you know, why do we have these giant oil spills? You know, these rigs, these oil platforms, they're engineered to the most cutting edge standards. And yet we have these catastrophic problems. And then we're going to use that same logic of, like, let's use technology to geoengineer out of this problem again. There's a paradox and some ironies there, too. I think that might be another interesting angle is, like, well, what would be another solution besides engineering this problem? You know, that was always going to be the go-to response because that's what drives our economy. But in the case of an oil spill, you already have the sort of precipitating factor is an engineering failure. You know, so then to use engineering again to kind of, you know, fix the problem. I mean, I think there's lots of examples from the past of how you get all these unintended consequences. And the reason that in this case I assume is moving forward is because they're minimizing the burden of it to the fisheries and indigenous people as opposed to the benefits to the companies that will be actually doing the engineering. Anyway, but it's a little bit outside of migration per se, but I think a lot of the same kinds of underlying drivers and dynamics are there.
There's actually a link to migration if you go back a little bit further and you think about the ways in which Hurricane Katrina was made many times worse than it might have been because of the destruction of the marshes and the barrier islands. Mm-hmm. So that gets destroyed for the benefit of the oil industry. It produces a complete disaster in New Orleans and massive numbers of people die and are displaced. And then you have same logic, same industry produces this massive oil spill. And the way they purport to address it is in a way that is, again, damaging to the ecosystem and, again, damaging to the people who live there and depend on that ecosystem. So as that history repeats itself, can we get out of this cycle, right? Can we come up with a better way?
Thank you. Carmen, so do you have time for one more question?
Sure. Some more.
Hey there, my name is Michael Warren. I'm with NJ Spotlight News in New Jersey. New Jersey is a historic hub of immigration, so a lot of the conversation today about, you know, international migration has been interesting and relevant to me, but I'm also curious about domestic migration and reporting on that. And I'm curious, particularly Sonia, what you see as the biggest similarities and differences that reporters should keep in mind when thinking about domestic versus international migration. Thank you.
I think that's a great question, and I wish there were more stories on domestic migration, because that is the majority of migration, not only in the United States, but in the whole world, is within national borders. And you know, if you think about like people moving from one part of the United States to the other, that's thousands of miles away. People have different accents, different cultures, different geographies, different landscapes. I mean, it's as big or bigger a move that you can do within the border of the United States than, say, from the Caribbean to here or Mexico to Texas, right, where those people share landscapes, they share cultures, the language. Like, there's lots of melding in those border areas. So the fact that we treat them so differently, I think, is really telling, you know, and that we have these acts. One thing I was looking at in my book is, how many of us have an act of long-distance migration in our past? And it's a huge proportion of us. Most of us in the United States are not more than maybe two generations removed from an act of long-distance migration. And that is usually crossing an international border, but sometimes not. You know, moving from California to Florida, that's thousands of miles away. And yet we're able to assimilate that very easily. Right? And why is that? I mean, it's such an interesting data point, you know, to contrast with, okay, somebody moves 20 miles from, you know, Mexico into Texas, and it's a huge headache, a problem, it's a political, you know, crisis, it's all these things, right? But somebody moves from, you know, the West Coast to the East Coast or into the middle of the country, it's like nothing. You assimilate right away. You know, maybe I'm not saying it's not disruptive. It's always just change is disruptive. There's always going to be some aspect of that, you know, people have to accommodate to. Yes. So I'm not, you know, I'm not minimizing that at all. But we're able to tolerate it. It's a tolerable amount of disruption that we're able to take it, because we're like, well, new people are coming in. That could be good. We need them for jobs. We need them for this, you know, all these things. And of course, that's not, you know, always the rule. But I think if we look on a case by case basis, most places, I was really surprised to find this when I was doing research for my book, that social science have looked at really deeply, is that when most people move, you know, within their countries, and when they move across borders, it's really usually just to the country right next door. And in most cases, they assimilate quickly. That conflict is, and xenophobia is actually the exception to the rule, that in most migrant flows, like, it just happens beneath our notice. It's the circulation in our body, and we're not noticing it. It's just sometimes certain migrant flows become highly visible and conspicuous, and that's because of racism, white nationalism, and all the rest of it. Once they become that way, then through our policies, we make them even more conspicuous. Make them line up. Make them have special papers. Make them, you know, give them the red letter or whatever. Like, it becomes to that extent that we want them to stick out, and you know, and everything kind of falls on from that, because you're actively creating barriers to assimilation. So I think the story of domestic migration is actually really fascinating, and most climate migration is happening within our borders. People are leaving the Chesapeake Bay right now because they're getting flooded out. There's whole areas of New York, I mean, you know this from New Jersey, that after Sandy, that are depopulated. People had to leave. So most of this climate migration is actually happening within the country. And, you know, yeah, it's disruptive. Things happen. It's, you know, something you have to manage for sure. But it's not a crisis. It's not, you know, it's not driving all of our politics the way even a smaller number of people crossing the southern border is. So I think that's a really interesting contrast and a great stories to write, because I think there's so much of this movement that's happening right now.
Thank you. So I'm going to give the last word to Carmen. If you have one last thing to add, I think we need to conclude.
One thing I would add is put numbers on it. People love numbers. You know that the numbers moving in the United States are huge, and the numbers coming into the United States, relatively speaking, are trivial. That's one way of sort of kind of making this point of, why are we focusing on this? What's the agenda behind this emphasis when, in fact, this is happening on such a massive scale and it's a big deal?
Please, a hand of applause for our speakers.
Thank you.
Thank you.